Advisement. Next is Investors Bank versus Javier Torres. If counsel could please come forward. Welcome, counsel. Mr. Deutsch.
May it please the court, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, please.
That's fine.
This court has been asked to resolve two questions. The first addresses the proper application of Section 3309 of New Jersey's Uniform Commercial Code governing the enforcement of loss promissory notes. And the second addresses whether the court of original jurisdiction improperly considered the loss note affidavit and evidence as a business exception to the hearsay rule. On the first issue, it was incorrectly determined that under the plain language of the UCC, Investors Bank can enforce the loss note affidavit to foreclose on the Torres home. Official comment one to New Jersey UCC 3203 explains issues of ownership and enforceability of promissory notes are distinct. Ownership is an issue of common law property rights, while enforceability is absolutely governed by the UCC and pursuant to Section 3301 requires possession. The one exception to that rule lies under Section 3309, where a promissory note has been deemed lost or destroyed. And there are two prerequisites for enforceability of a lost note. Under 3309A, the party seeking to enforce the lost note must prove it was in possession of the instrument prior to the loss. Second, under subsection B, once that is proven, they must also prove the contents of the note. Investors Bank cannot, under any circumstances, satisfy the first prong of 3309. The lost note affidavit was executed by City Mortgage, which asserts itself to have been the last entity to possess the note prior to loss. Since 2002, the LI drafters of the UCC have recommended that states amend 3309 to permit transferring rights of lost notes for enforceability. But New Jersey has declined to amend the statute. And this court should follow the conclusions of sister jurisdictions, including Connecticut, Rhode Island, and Massachusetts, who also have not adopted the proposed amendments, to hold that the plain language of 3309 does not allow for transferring of rights of enforceability of a lost note instrument. The two primary arguments relied upon by Investors Bank and their supporting amicus for upholding the decision below should be rejected. Primarily, they argue first, without supporting data, that if 3309 is applied as written to prohibit transferring enforcement rights of lost notes, there will be a catastrophic impact on the secondary loan market. It's unfounded, that claim. And then they argue that should the court reverse and not allow transferability of rights and apply 3309 as written, that Torres would receive a windfall. That is also not true. The second question on appeal is procedural and asks whether the courts below erred in determining the lost promissory note affidavit was appropriately entered into evidence under the business exception hearsay rule. Within this question, I believe that it's paramount that the court provide guidance on whether consideration of the lost note affidavit was to occur at the summary judgment stage or under the bifurcated final judgment stage in the foreclosure process. The appellate court concluded that the lost note affidavit was properly authenticated into evidence, although the original trial court said this issue will be determined at final judgment stage, and when we got to final judgment and we were remanded back to Bergen County, the judge said, the original trial court already ruled on this issue, so I'm going to let it go through and we're going to have final judgment. So nobody really ever ruled on this issue. But ultimately, the business exception rule requires three things to be proven. One, that the document be executed in the ordinary course of business. Two, that it be created a short time after the event reflected. And three, that the circumstances of creation must justify admissibility. Here, the second two prongs are also not satisfied. City Mortgage could not locate the instrument years before the lost note affidavit was executed. And it's clear that the lost note affidavit was executed for the purpose of use in litigation because we had a prior foreclosure where they chose to walk away before trial, and then we had a secondary foreclosure after a lost note affidavit was executed, allegedly sold with the alleged transfer of rights to enforce. So that was clearly an untrustworthy document as it was prepared for the purpose of litigation. Open up for questions at this time.
So you're advancing a plain language argument as to the meaning of Section 309, and as applied here, it would mean that someone who hasn't paid a mortgage payment since 2010 and has a debt of more than $900,000 could continue to live in the property. How is that not an absurd outcome?
Your Honor, there's two components the way that I hear the question. Number one, there's a focus on the time length that's at play here. And I want to emphasize that Mr. and Mrs. Torres are not responsible for any delay in this case. There was an original foreclosure filed back in 2010, and in 2011, Investors Bank chose not to pursue the trial at the end.
So my focus is more on the future.
On the future.
Not on what's happened.
But so
your rule of law would allow them to continue living in this property without paying anything.
But it would not result in an absurd outcome of the Torres having a windfall. Because in this particular situation, we do have a circumstance, and I think in the majority of lost note cases, we have a circumstance where the prior entity is still around. So in this case, this is really a question of I believe, contract law between City Mortgage and Investors Bank.
Respectfully, you're not answering the question. From the perspective of your clients, somebody else in the same situation would have been foreclosed on, and there would be no objection. They had nothing to do with the loss of the note. It's just tremendous serendipity on their part. They get they get without paying their mortgage for in excess of a decade to stay in the home. Why is that a just result?
To directly answer, Your Honor, my client has attempted to pay the loan. My client has attempted to offer repayment plans that have all been rejected. Number two, the plaintiff could have gone through with the foreclosure sale and eviction while this was pending. There was never any stay put into place by my client. So any perceived equitable windfall for delay is not really with my client in the driver's seat.
Asking about the delay, counsel. I think they're asking about the fact that your client will remain in a home and without any recourse where he owes $900,000. I don't think anyone's questioning about whose fault the delay was. They're talking present day.
And
how is that not an absurd result?
My client would like to pay. The reality of the banking system with mortgages.
Put that to one side.
Yes.
Because if you're correct, your client doesn't have to repay. The holder of the mortgage under circumstances like this really has no recourse against your client. Isn't that the logical extension of what you're arguing? They can't foreclose on it.
Your Honor, use language that the holder of
Investors Bank.
Investors Bank
cannot foreclose under the logic of your argument.
I believe that under the plain language of the UCC, Investors Bank cannot foreclose. I think that's correct. I think City Mortgage can.
So the fact that your client may or may not have offered a loan modification is really of no moment to that principle. The next client could say, I'm not paying anything. Note was lost. I get to live here scot-free. Why is that not an absurd outcome from this plain language reading?
The court may feel that it is an absurd outcome, but it is the outcome that the legislature has provided us.
Right.
When we look at other sections of the UCC, it is very clear that that is the exact outcome. And what I would like to point the court to is under section 3203, which is titled Transfer of Instruments, it's made clear that the transfer of an instrument happens upon delivery. So we get another section focusing on delivery. Now, under official comment provided to us by the legislature, official comment one, it says, the right to enforce an instrument and ownership of the instrument are two different concepts. Ownership rights in instruments may be determined by the principles of law of property, independent of Article 3, which does not depend upon whether the instrument was transferred under Section 3203. Moreover, a person who has an ownership right in an instrument might not be a person entitled to enforce the instrument. For example, and this is key, suppose X is the owner and holder of an instrument payable to X. X sells the instrument to Y, but is unable to deliver immediate possession to Y. Instead, X signs a document conveying all of X's right, title, and interest in the instrument to Y. Although the document may be effective to give Y a claim to ownership of the instrument, Y is not a person entitled to enforce the instrument until Y obtains possession of the instrument. And so the drafters gave us what has been described to me today as an absurd result.
So it's really absurd. I've read your brief. I thought you said that one of the options here is for investors to unreal the transaction. Investors can sell its right back to Citibank, and then Citibank can engaged in a foreclosure action. And the other side of it, and this is your argument, is whether or not a bank staring at the plain language of a statute can just go off and violate the statute and then argue that it's going to be totally unjust for the person to be sitting in the house without paying rent after the bank has violated the clear language of the law.
Wasn't that the
argument in your brief? No?
I'm not sure that I understood the second part of the
question. The second part is you're saying that the plain language forbade Citibank from transferring the note that it was not permitted to investors. So when it did so knowing, and investors knowing, because they have competent counsel, that investors was not going to be able to foreclose. So they did that at their own peril.
I think that's right. I think that's an issue of contractual disagreement between city and investors.
They shouldn't be violating the law and then thinking that they're somehow going to get the windfall out of it. That's the other side of the absurd coin argument over here. As a bank should not think, or banks, that they can violate the law and somehow get a remedy.
I agree, Your Honor, and I think that in this particular situation, investors, because we have a loss note affidavit that predates the supposed, well, at least it predates the assignment of mortgage. We don't know from this record when exactly this sale occurred between city and investors.
Let me ask you about the first part of Justice Albin's question, which is the remedy. Is it your position, because it frankly didn't come through loud and clear from the brief to me, is it your position that the remedy here is to reassign it for whatever price is negotiated back to city and they foreclose? I didn't see that suggested by you exactly.
That is a plausible outcome.
Plausible outcome, you were saying. That, now, what if city, absolutely. Because banks have a way of changing their identities with frequency sometimes, is no longer the same entity that owned the note? Would you take the position then that they are no longer in a position to foreclose?
So to answer that question directly, I want to be clear that 3309 provides for the circumstance where loss is because of seizure or a bank going out of business.
What if city says, no, thank you? We hear your offer, investors. We're really not interested.
I think that Investors Bank has a very good contract claim, and I think that...
What's the basis of that? Because as you just pointed out for us, the affidavit was generated before the assignment. So the cards were on the table. Everybody understood what was going on. No?
I have not seen the purchase and sale agreement between city and investors, so I do not know what the precise language is, but I do know that under Article 3 of the UCC, ownership of the instrument may have been transferred outside of the UCC, as this comment tells us, because that's a question of property rights. But the actual right to enforce the instrument is different. That's governed by the UCC. And so an entity can own an instrument and not have a right to enforce it. I mean, we are told that by the drafters very clearly. And that is the exact roadmap here.
I'm still not unsure. I'm not sure how investors could unwind this transaction in light of what we know. Can you tell us?
Sure. So presumably investors can discuss with Citi the idea of transferring it back to them.
For sure.
They can have some kind of contractual arrangement between them where either it's
go to the harder case. What if that conversation, that genteel conversation...
Where Citi merges. Citi is now purchased by Bank of America. Citi no longer exists.
Citi exists and says, thank you very much. We appreciate your entreaty.
Yeah.
Not interested.
Then I think investors is in trouble. I do think that investors are in trouble because they have a promissory note that can't be enforced.
And your client cannot be foreclosed on. They can go for the next 30 years, hope they have a good long lives, and they can live in the house and never pay any mortgage payments, and that's the end of it. Because a note that was preserved electronically, the original piece of paper was lost.
That's correct, Your Honor, but the preserved electronic issue is problematic. Because if we go down that road, then anybody who has a copy of the record from the court below with a copy of the digital note can come forward and say, I have a copy.
I'm just saying that's your position. I mean, really, that is your position.
That's the position of the legislature when they passed this version of the UCC.
Well, it's more than that. It's the position that many states have taken, the great majority who have been asked to do this question of statutory interpretation. Isn't that correct? Most of the states that looked at their 309 before it was amended to match the current UCC standard have come to the conclusion that you're arguing for. Isn't that right?
I do think that's correct. There is obviously a split, but it does appear to
There's
me that...
There's a split, but the greater majority goes your way.
I agree.
May I ask a question? You've been relying on plain language, and I know many of the decisions do, but one of your fellow amici has raised a question, has raised an argument based upon the earlier iteration of our UCC provisions, specifically Section 3804, where the legislature, before it moved to 309, had looked at ownership and then switched to language under 309 that now requires only the possession, the party that was in possession, to be able to pursue on the basis of a lost note affidavit. Do you agree with that?
I do agree with that, and I think that it makes sense, and particularly when we look at
Why have no courts before that, the courts in this case, not picked up on that legislative history before?
In terms of the context of New Jersey, there's fairly minimal case law on the lost note cases. This is, to be honest, this is my fourth lost note case.
This is pretty significant legislative history that has a great impact on your position, I think.
I think that Your Honor's right. It does, and I wish that I had made a bigger issue of that in the court below, absolutely.
And when the legislature moved to 309, they adopted the comment, too, did they not?
They did.
And that's also supportive of the same interpretation.
That's correct.
Doesn't the UCC specifically provide that our statutory and common law supplements its specific provisions?
It does. Under Section 1103, it does state that unless displaced by particular provisions of the UCC, it can be supplemented. When you look to comment 3 of under that rule, the official comment, it does say that equitable principles may supplement provisions of the UCC only if they are consistent with the purposes and policies of the UCC as well as its text. And I do believe that the argument my client is putting forward here, particularly in the context of both 3203 and 3301 and 3309, that the arguments for using common law would be inappropriate, particularly when we look at 203 and it says that ownership is determined by property law.
But there's also a lot of history behind the UCC that talks about facilitating commercial transactions, frankly, promoting assignments, and our statutes, and frankly, this is a foreclosure, so it's an equitable remedy, correct? Equity would apply.
It is heard in a court of equity, absolutely.
Okay, and our laws regarding assignment are very, very different than what you're suggesting the UCC requires. They promote assignment, and they would allow this transaction were it not for your interpretation of the UCC?
Well, I think the question goes to the heart of the recommended amendments that ALI made back in 2002.
Let me ask you this then. The courts that have gone along with your position, do any of them have similar state statutory provisions or common law history that would seem to go against the UCC's plain language here? Any of them have similar statutes, similar common law?
My understanding is that they do, that the common law of assignability of mortgages, the view of a mortgage and a note being two distinct instruments, that tends to flow in the other jurisdictions as well.
How about this assignment statute? Same thing in those other states?
I do not know the precise language of the other states. I do believe that they have some language to that effect. The states that we're dealing with are also, to be clear, they're not all judicial foreclosure states. So, for example, Massachusetts, where I presently reside, is not. a judicial foreclosure state. And so it is dealt with differently.
It's an illegal setting, not an equitable setting.
Say that again?
It's an illegal setting, not an equitable setting.
I'm not sure that I can answer or confirm that distinction.
And you can't really confirm what their statutory provisions are that might be inconsistent with the interpretation of the UCC that you're espousing.
That's true. I do not have the precise language in front of me right now.
309 is basically an anti-assignment statute, wouldn't you say? It's an anti-assignment statute, yes, because it's saying the only person who can enforce the lost instrument is the person who lost it.
It's interesting. I don't know whether it's anti-assignment. I want to. The language is tricky, right? Under the UCC, we talk about transfer, not assignment, too. So it is tricky. When we're dealing with assignment, I think we're dealing with ownership. When we're dealing with transfer, we're dealing with enforceability. So there is a little bit of to get hung up, but I don't know that this is anti-transferability or anti-assignment 3309. I think that its ultimate goal is to seek certainty.
How do we know that the legislature's decision not to adopt the revisions in 2002 means anything other than that they thought our assignment statute trumped any suggestion that there couldn't be an assignment in these circumstances? I mean, obviously you're arguing, well, they made a conscious decision not to go this way and to keep the law as you say it is, but how do we know they weren't simply looking at the broad language of our assignment statute in New Jersey and saying, this is not going to matter. We don't need any new revision here because we have a broad assignability under our statute.
To the best of my knowledge, there is no statute speaking directly to assignability of promissory notes. I mean, the statute that Your Honor is referencing deals with assignment of mortgages exclusively. And our case law makes clear that they are two distinct instruments. I mean, there's a little
No, it doesn't. It specifically refers to chooses an action.
It's a very general statute.
And the chosen action is a promissory note.
Counsel, can we glean some legislative intent from the fact that they moved from language of ownership to language of possession?
Can Your Honor ask that one more time?
The legislature moved from language of owner under 3804 to language of being in possession of the note at the time that it was lost. So clearly they understood the difference. And if we were talking about assignability, there would have been no need to move to possession. So I'm wondering, let me ask the question in a different way. If we turn to our law on assignability, are we supplementing our law or are we supplanting it? Are we actually changing the meaning of 309?
I believe that we're absolutely changing the meaning of 3309. And I believe that we're specifically told at the beginning of New Jersey's UCC and through the comments that the sections are supposed to be taken in a whole too. And I think 3309 can't be read in a vacuum.
We've been pretty careful about when we turn to the common law. Not too long ago, we had a case called Oratami where we were being asked to use common law principles to add to what the UCC said. And we were quite reluctant. This court was quite reluctant to do that and declined.
And I think that's the right position to be taken here as well, particularly when we have multiple sections that are supposed to be read together that make clear the key to enforcement is possession. Ownership is a totally different issue, we're told, and we're told that only an entity that ever had possession of a lost instrument can enforce that instrument.
How do you interpret the amendment in 2002 to the UCC by the American Law Institute? If you look at comment 2, it seems to suggest they just don't agree with the Jostlin decision. They think it was off base, and that's why they are putting this language in, not that they thought it read any differently before and after. What's your understanding of the purpose behind the amendment in 2002?
I think that's fair. There's a fair reading to say that ALI wants to see a different result, and that I think business wants to see a different result. And I understand that concept, but it's also an acknowledgement that as originally drafted, I do think it's an acknowledgement that as originally drafted, courts were enforcing the plain language to come up with a result that they were not pleased with the outcome of.
Jocelyn,
I think the disagreement
really
of the outcome of Jocelyn has more to do with what the result was than whether or not the plain language was properly interpreted by the courts at the time.
Mm-hmm.
I take it your position is we shouldn't be using principles of equity or the common law to overthrow a plainly clear-written statute.
Absolutely.
How about statutory language on the assignment? And you indicated your understanding of our assignment statute, but if our assignment statute is properly read to include this, why shouldn't we use that to supplement? I'm not talking about common law. Why shouldn't we use that to supplement our understanding of how our legislature would approach this issue?
So the assignment statute presumably is NJSIA 46-9-9, and that statute results in any transfer of a right to enforce a promissory note or a debt. It begins with all mortgages on real estate in this state and all covenants and stipulations therein contained shall be assignable at law by writing. But we're told from our long history of judicial decisions that the mortgage generally would follow the note, that the note itself is the obligation. The mortgage is merely incidental. They can be separated.
Sorry, what statute do I, and I was just...
The assignment of mortgages statute would be 46-9-9.
I'm talking about 2A-25-1, all contracts for the sale and conveyance of real estate and all choses in action arising on contracts shall be assignable, and the assignee may sue thereon in his own name.
Your Honor, I do believe that amicus will be speaking to the choice of action question, as Your Honor is asking me, and I'd like to the opportunity to defer that to amicus if possible.
I take that your reading of the statute, the reason why I used anti-assignment,
no.
A plain reading seems to suggest that the only person who can enforce the lost note is the person who lost the note.
Correct.
All right. That by, if you read it that way, of course it can't be assignable.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
Anything you'd like to add?
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
But doesn't the fact that a digital copy of the original note and mortgage documents were made before the disappearance and they were attached to the lost note affidavit, isn't that supportive of the lost note affidavit and something that defendant can rely on? What plaintiffs can rely on?
Is Your Honor asking from the evidentiary question that was posed or from the perspective of 3309?
3309.
Presumably the way that the statute reads, one would have to prove the terms of the note under subsection B. So having a copy of it is one way to certainly
and it's a digital copy.
Yes.
Would the rules of evidence, best evidence rule, play a part here? A substitute copy, which would be the electronic copy, would that play a part in there? Because that would be admissible under Rule 1000.
So the best evidence rule, in terms of having a photocopy as opposed to the original document where it's lost, I do understand that. I think that
wouldn't
the
that
issue
have the same effect then as having the original, if we apply the rules of evidence, the best evidence rule?
I do not believe so, and I think that would be a grave mistake for that to happen, because as I was alluding to, the problem with copies, and we do live in a digital age, the issue is that anyone who could go onto the court's website and download the record from summary judgment or anything like that would have a digital copy.
Don't the rules of evidence provide for that? For a copy?
They allow for a copy, but something more than that. It requires for a witness to authenticate the document. It requires more than simply
that done here?
A copy.
Didn't a witness authenticate the document from the electronic copy? Say this is what it is. Here are the terms. Isn't that what's embodied
in
the rule?
We literally have a statement to the effect of "I cannot find the note," but they have the affidavit on summary judgment. And this is remarkable. It simply says we can't find the note, but this party has standing, and that's what it says. I mean,
nonetheless, the facts are that there is an electronic copy. I'm not that
there's
a lot of rules of the rules of evidence that would be admissible in substitute for the original copy, would it not?
I don't think that in this particular circumstance it should. I think that there's a real problem with the law. Why? What we have here is we have a real problem with the lost note affidavit, where there is no information provided as to what search was done to determine how it was lost, where it was lost.
Is that required under the best evidence rule?
Under the best evidence rule, no, it is not under the best evidence rule. I think that it is an issue in terms of that secondary issue on appeal. I think that it's a real concern that neither court on the trial level, the original court that heard the summary judgment stage and then the bifurcated one when we got to final judgment, neither of them looked to the loss note affidavit to determine whether or not it has actually been proven. Nobody looked at city's affidavit presenting the loss note affidavit to say, yes, they did a search. Yes, it makes clear when the last time they had it was. We don't have any proof that city ever possessed the note, and nobody was ever put to the test.
I may be wrong on this. I thought there was a statement that there was a diligent search and they looked for it and they weren't able to find it. Now, maybe I'm remembering that from a different case, but I thought that was that.
The affidavit states.
Yeah, I thought it said it was misplaced, lost, or destroyed, and that city had conducted a thorough and diligent search but couldn't find it. That's just my notes. That's not
meant. It's at DA 14 of the original of the record from the appellate division, and it is, to my mind, a remarkably vague statement, particularly for a document that was prepared in the context of going to litigation.
It's not. And it's not uncommon when we're dealing with bundled loans, right? I mean, that's how typically these kinds of affidavits are written, are they not?
That is often how they are written, and the record below shows that in answering interrogatories, it was answered that they were unaware of any searches for lost documents or something to that effect.
Yeah. As they searched, I'm looking at DA 14, they searched the loan files and image documents. No one has been able to locate the original note.
Now, it would seem to me that a key missing fact from that lost note affidavit is we have a record that at one time we possessed the note. Now we search for it
and
we
can't
find it.
So, yeah.
But that's an important fact that is missing. I mean, that if we have to infer from reading this document that city ever possessed it.
Okay, so I want you to respond to the questions that were asked to the left of me, and that's with respect to copies and whether a digital copy is the equivalent of an instrument, the instrument itself, under 309.
I think it can make it in on best evidence rule. I do not think that there was any reading, any consideration by any of the courts as to the veracity, reliability, probative value, etc., of the instrument itself, and that was a failure on the courts below.
Did I understand you correctly a minute ago to say that there is a question as to whether city ever possessed the document?
I think that when we look at this document, the lost note affidavit doesn't say we had possession, I know where it was,
and that
I looked in that location.
That they ever possessed it?
It doesn't say in this lost note affidavit that they did. There was no evidence put to the court below to show that they ever did.
Well, they copied. They have a digital copy of it, so that didn't come out of the ether. Really, is there any claim whatsoever this thing never existed?
I understand. We approach the. Is there any claim that it never existed? No, my client doesn't claim that a note was not executed.
Yeah, but or that it was never in the city's possession.
It is not, to my mind, that is not a fact that was proven in the court below.
But
and I think that
saying,
was.
I'm trying to understand one of your earlier answers. Are you saying that if the court made a finding that the digital copy is a true and fair copy of the actual instrument, that could substitute for the term instrument in 309?
Absolutely not. A photocopy cannot stand in the place of the original instrument under the plain language of the UCC. Absolutely, unequivocally, no.
Where does it say that? It just says that the instrument. The instrument could be the copy under the best evidence rule. If it's admitted in evidence under the rule, then it is the instrument.
The problem is the UCC
does not. You're not required to have
the
original document anymore. That went away back in 1968.
The UCC speaks to possession. It does not speak to possession of a copy, and that would be the distinguishing factor.
But you don't claim that the defendant has a defense to the foreclosure or that the defendant has, in fact, not paid the amount of money claimed.
To the latter, my client does not dispute being in default on a mortgage loan. To the former, as to a defense.
This is a defense, right?
Absolutely.
Okay, let me back that up. So your client is not sitting here saying that he has, that he does not owe the money claimed.
That's correct. There's a question as to whom it's owed.
Gotcha. And you don't claim that somehow the mortgage document is defective, correct?
The mortgage security instrument, there's not a claim of defectiveness.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Deutsch.
Thank you.
We have three amici today, and I invite all of you to feel free to adopt arguments that precede you as you make your presentations. Ms. Katniss.
Good afternoon, and may it please the court. I'll first start by addressing Justice Solomon and Patterson's questions about 2A25-1. So first, negotiable instruments are not choses in action, they're choses in possession. And there is case law on this. It's Morris and Canal Banking Company v. Fisher. It's from 1855. It is an old case, but it makes clear that negotiable instruments are not choses in action, they are choses in possession. So that doesn't even apply here. And then I don't think that an electronic copy can be used. The UCC has always been read to need the original version, and that is the correct interpretation of the statute. I think, you know, there are times where, for instance, checks can be used, electronic copies for checks, but there were separate federal and state statutory schemes that allowed for that, like the Federal Check 21 Act, New Jersey has UEDA, the Uniform Electronic Transfer Act. So absent some kind of statutory scheme that would allow the digital copy to be used, a digital copy cannot be used. And further, even if you were going to allow a digital copy, this isn't the case to do it, because Citi claimed that the note was endorsed to it, and Investors Bank claimed that the note was endorsed to it, but neither of those endorsements made it to the electronic file. If you look at the note that was provided at final judgment, it has no endorsements. So the digital copy here is clearly flawed. I'd like to address an argument made by investors and the industry in their briefs that this court can sidestep a decision under 3309 entirely by finding that because Citi or because investors had a valid assignment of mortgage, that's all that's needed to foreclose. Legal Services urges this court not to go down this path and to hold that to have standing to foreclose, a plaintiff needs both possession of the note and a valid assignment of mortgage at the time the foreclosure is filed. The Appellate Division articulated the correct standard for standing in a foreclosure matter in Ford, which was that a party seeking to foreclose must own or control the underlying debt. It was later in Mitchell, in what appears to have been dictum, that the court issued a new standard for standing, which was that either possession of the note or a valid assignment of mortgage would have been enough to foreclose. This has led to confusion within the Appellate Division, with Russo and Angeles stating the standard, but then in Peck, it said that if the mortgage and note were split, you need both, but even though they didn't have possession of the note, they still allowed the judgment to stand. And then in Residential Mortgage, more recently, they said both are needed, but again, possession of the note couldn't be proven and the foreclosure, the standing was held to have been had by that plaintiff. Mitchell and its progeny are wrong because the note matters. The note is the underlying instrument. A mortgage is merely a security for that instrument. The mortgage does not exist without the note.
Without the note, you wouldn't know how much is owed.
Correct. Or that's correct. You wouldn't know the interest rate, you wouldn't know the amount of the payments, you wouldn't know the amortization schedule without the note. Assignment of a mortgage does not and cannot transfer the rights of the note, which is governed by the UCC. And whether enforcing as a holder, a non-holder, or pursuant to 3309, possession, at least in some point in time, is the key to enforcing it. And there's a valid policy reason for this possession requirement, which is that it protects borrowers against the risk of double liability. And this risk was perfectly exemplified in the New Jersey bankruptcy case in Ray Kemp. And there, in 2009, the creditor came forward with a lost note affidavit that was signed in 2007 and said, we lost the note. And then a few weeks later said, no, we found the note. This is really troubling because under the UCC, If the rule is that you can continue to transfer under a lost note affidavit while the original note is still in existence and can be further negotiated, you've created two streams of enforcement potentially for the same debt obligation, and you have exposed the borrower to an unacceptable amount of risk of double liability on that note.
And that's not this case.
Right.
That's not this case. No one is suggesting there's a double.
No, but anytime there's a lost note affidavit, there is a risk that the original note is in existence somewhere.
And that's worked out by courts by figuring out whose claims are correct, if that is presumably when that occurs.
Yes, assuming that, you know, the individual would get counsel. Most.
But your argument is.
The trial court worked that out already in this case.
Work out what?
The trial court afford that protection already in this case.
The indemnification?
Yeah.
By providing the indemnification? Yes. But the, I don't think you even get to subsection B, whether indemnification, and it's actually adequate protection. You don't even get there if you don't comply with subsection A, which requires possession at the time of loss.
You were making your point in order to show that there was a policy reason for the legislature to have done what it did.
Yes.
Okay.
And it's to protect against double liability. Mm-hmm.
And whether or not it's a good policy or it's a strong policy, it's the one they chose.
Correct. And New Jersey is free to adopt the amendments to the UCC if it would like to do so.
Can I ask you the same question I asked earlier? New Jersey appears to have embraced the UCC as it existed before 2002, correct?
Yes.
And the UCC's drafters didn't think this problem existed before Jocelyn, correct?
Yes, I think that is correct. But you can look at the prior history of this, of New Jersey specifically, and I think it was Justice LaVecchia that pointed out that ownership was the key. It was 804, it required ownership, and you could transfer ownership, and that would be enough. And that was removed from the statute when 3309, mm-hmm. and that made possession the key to enforcing it. And the reason is to protect against double liability. And even if you think the risks are small, or that they could be worked out in another court, possession is required.
If the legislature disliked the risks of lost note affidavit, why would it accept it from the entity that owned the note at the time it was lost? There's no, in other words, you're saying that Citi could have enforced this note even though it lost it.
Yes.
If the legislature had a strong policy of we're not accepting lost notes, why would it allow the party that lost the note to enforce it nonetheless?
I think you have less evidentiary concerns when it's the party that lost the note, that I think the risk of another action on that note is lower. But when you start allowing transfers, and we know the transfer of paper has been not great for mortgages, that the concerns are greater.
But you know, obviously we have a trial court that's very well experienced in foreclosure that had a very easy response, which is that investors indemnify Mr. Torres for any potential claim from an alternative claimant.
So I would argue indemnification isn't enough, and again, you only get to subsection B if A is complied with. And I think that the reason for that is to keep the number of lost note affidavits low, because anytime there's a lost note affidavit, there's this risk of double liability. But indemnification, it's not enough, especially for legal services clients who don't have the money to hire attorneys. An indemnification clause is in itself going to require litigation. And most people, when they're fighting either foreclosure or debts generally, the judgments enter by default, by and large. So to say that indemnification is enough, for legal services clients, it's not. They're most likely not going to go out and get attorneys.
And as you indicated, the legislature may very well have been concerned about evidentiary concerns and may have wanted the person who lost the note to come to court, the person being the company, to explain how it was lost, maybe in addition to the affidavit. That becomes a little bit more difficult when the lost note affidavit is transferred down the line.
That's exactly right. And I do think that, although I can't cite to anything specifically, I do think that the evidentiary issue is the reason why you don't even get to indemnification unless you have possession.
There was a bill introduced in 2012 and then later was reintroduced and enacted in 2013 to make a number of changes to the UCC, Chapter 1, Chapter 4A, Chapter 7, Chapter 9. There were, I could not find any suggestion that amendments to 309 in the wake of Joslyn or the 2002 UCC amendments were ever percolating in those amendments. Are you aware of anything to the contrary?
No.
Although there was actually in 2013 an amendment to 3308, which was a terminology change from incompetent to incapacitated, clearly a very minor change, but they were at one time recently looking at Chapter 3.
Correct, and they did not adopt the amendment, the proposed language. So even if that was maybe the intent of the drafters of the UCC, the New Jersey legislature maybe has a totally different.
Do we read a lot into what the legislature doesn't do generally in our case law?
No, but you can look into what it did do, which was change from ownership from 804 into possession in 3309.
So then why can't we employ the canon of statutory interpretation, as we said in DeLisa, that the spirit of the law should control where a literal interpretation would create a manifestly absurd result, which is, I think, what we have here.
Well, I disagree that it would be an absurd result to enforce the statute as written. City could have completed this foreclosure back in 2011, and it chose not to. And then investors chose to buy this debt knowing that there were issues with enforcement. And we have no idea, as Mr. Deutsch said, what the purchase agreement was like. Maybe they knew that there was a problem with this debt and there's some kind of sellback provision or something in there that does protect them. If there's not, there should have been, because they should have known that this was problematic at the time that they purchased it.
And you don't see this as a windfall for Mr. Torres?
No, because City can still foreclose, assuming that debt
gets negotiated. City can't foreclose unless there's another transaction. City has no right to foreclose right now. There would have to be an additional transaction.
Well,
right?
Potentially, or an agreement between investors and City that City can be the entity that forecloses.
If City walked in here and tried to foreclose, your very competent colleague would be winning that motion so fast that it would make your head spin. They don't even claim to own the note anymore, right? They assigned it.
They assigned it so they can assign it back. Yes, I think another agreement would need to be reached or enforcement of the whatever the sale agreement was, because we don't know whether that was, and it seems like it should have been done, some kind of provision in the sale agreement that City would take this debt back if it turned out to be unenforceable.
Seems like we're really speculating about that, aren't we?
Yes.
The only reason why we're presented with the absurd result argument is because City and investors decided to violate the plain language of 3309.
Correct. And I would say that equity follows the law. And the law here is clear. The UCC is clear that it's coming down on in favoring borrowers, protecting them from double liability.
And would you say that the arguments on the other side by your adversaries are better addressed to the legislature?
Yes, absolutely.
Anything you'd like to add?
I'll just conclude by saying that this court can and should make it clear that it will not make foreclosures easier to prosecute at the expense of borrower protections that are enshrined in New Jersey law.
Thank you. Professor Fisher.
Your Honors, basic black letter law under Article 3 of the UCC, transfer of enforcement rights in a negotiable instrument occurs by intentional transfer and delivery of physical possession of the negotiable note, not by assignment. It's a bottom line necessity, can reach the conclusion easily by harmonizing sections 3203, 3301, and 3309. As Myron Weinstein, the Dean of New Jersey Foreclosures, has noted, the note is the cow and the mortgage the tail. The cow can survive without a tail, but the tail cannot survive without the cow. Continuing this analogy, A lost note affidavit is not a cow. A mortgage is a cow. So it follows that just because a mortgage or lost note affidavit is assigned, one cannot conclude that the right to enforcement contained in the note is transferred as well. Dale Whitman, the foremost national authority on mortgage law, and whose text I use when I teach land finance, agrees with Mr. Weinstein's position as well. This case is another step removed from 3309A in that Investors Bank was never in possession of the note, only an affidavit that is not assignable. Now, and I'm not going to rehearse that argument because that's been presented at length already. We do not deny that law and equity continue to inform the doctrine of negotiable notes, but they do not supersede or undermine its basic premises. And that's what would occur here if Investor Bank's position is followed. With what result? Any electronic copy of a negotiable note could be stapled to a lost note assignment and be negotiable. We all know that multiple contradictory copies of notes float around in these cases, as occurred in this case as well, creating a lot of confusion. Which note is right? It's not always clear. We don't want to give lenders here the perverse incentive of switching up the paperwork at various times. It would be something all courts should want to be tamped down and, to the extent possible, eliminated. So the lesson that I draw from this is that the further removed we get from the original negotiable note, the greater the likelihood that confusion and mistakes will result. And therefore, the use of lost note affidavits should be limited to the one that had possession of the negotiable note at some point. The narrow exception in 3309 should stay that way and not become a slippery slope. There are plenty of slippery slopes in foreclosure law, as we can see going through the appellate division cases on standing to foreclose, for instance. So let me address equity now. Investors Bank and its amicus make much of the fact that there would be an absurd
Should equity consider if someone's getting free milk here from the cow?
Well, good point. We can talk about free milk. Free houses. I have to admit, Your Honor, I hadn't quite considered it that way. But if you wish to continue the analogy, I'm open to questioning.
Please, no.
But is it really equitable to allow this foreclosure to go through under these circumstances? Equity works both ways.
Well, let's start with this. Is it equitable for there if you agree with your colleague's position that there is no recourse unless Citi happens to A, be in a position to take back this note, and B, decide to do so, and it might have very good reasons not to? Is it equitable for the result that the defendants are seeking, which is that they can't be foreclosed on no matter how many years have gone by since they paid a mortgage payment?
In itself, absent context, it doesn't seem particularly equitable, I have to admit. But how equitable is it, on the other hand, if an entity, a financial institution, is getting payments or the right to foreclose from a borrower if it doesn't have the right to enforce it under the UCC? This is what I mean in part when I say equity runs both ways. No matter what's decided here, there is going to be a certain amount of windfall or inequity. I don't see that that's avoidable. But I also think that the inequities that look like inequities in isolation cancel each other out.
So if a client came into the clinic.
Sorry?
If a client came into the clinic and presented circumstances like this, your answer, I take it, would be you don't have to pay a nickel because even though you acknowledge you owe this money, they don't have the right to enforce.
There may be other equitable set-offs, possible. I mean, maybe use and occupancy. I haven't thought this through in great detail, but I would not be willing to say there is no other recourse in either law or equity. I think that question just hasn't been addressed yet. And one thing I have to say about equity is it's very creative and over the centuries has been really good at formulating remedies and responses in individual cases that can address the situation while reducing any inequities that might occur to the extent possible.
Whatever we say here is going to be followed by the parties. So if we were to agree with the banks that this is going to be an equitable windfall to the borrower here, we're basically eviscerating the statute for the future. Because the question is whether or not one of the questions we have is whether we're going to enforce this statute as written. Correct?
Yes. Well, for the future, I would assume that lenders would take the court's decision into consideration. And as for...
if this court were to rule in favor of the defendant here, then presumably banks will take notice that they shouldn't be transferring the affidavit to someone who can't enforce this lost note.
Correct. And, you know, at the time this transaction was consummated, the pricing of mortgages and notes on the secondary market took into account existing law. So I don't see in any way that we're going to create the parade of horribles that the bank counsel sets forth in their brief, and believe that the market works here. The market has worked here in light of the law at the time. But I also take some issue with the notion that the Torreses are getting a, quote, free house. I mean, it's a nice rhetorical device. We hear it a lot. In fact, almost always in these cases when similar issues come up, but how free is it really? There's no evidence in the record, but people living under uncertain legal circumstances, standing in the future in front of the likelihood that they're going to lose their house, I don't see that as exactly free living or a vacation on the beach.
You don't see, you know, when people are obviously some struggling to pay their mortgages, you don't see it a windfall if people are able to stay in a house for decades not paying a mortgage because of the tension that somebody may catch up with them with a foreclosure?
Well, the decades is not presented here. If we were talking
decades
about
are potentially presented here, because I think what we're hearing is that there's a real prospect that there is no remedy at all in this case if a transaction sending this note back to city turns out to be impossible. Thank you, Chief.
Well, I had suggested previously in response to a somewhat similar question that there may be other equitable remedies available, such as use and occupancy.
Meaning what? Use and occupancy, insist they pay rent?
Basically, yes.
By who? To who?
Well, that's an issue.
Yeah, so I think there's a gentleman here who would be jumping all over that immediately.
They're not the owner. They're a holder of a mortgage.
Well, and again, you know, a lot of what everybody is saying here is speculation from us, from the banks, from all, because we haven't seen the purchase and sale agreement. We don't know what buyback provisions are there, what representations and warranties. Ordinarily, of course, the pooling and servicing agreements did include them. So it's,
The bank should comp before us and say that that Citibank won't buy it back. We don't know that.
We don't know that.
So we shouldn't speculate about that.
Yeah.
The burden should be on the bank to say that they're stuck.
Well, you said that much better than I could have. Thank you.
That's the beauty of the justice to my right.
Anything you'd like to add?
You just give me a moment here to see whether, to what extent the rest of my arguments have already been covered. Investors Bank also raises the possibility of subrogation, but I don't really see how that could work here. Who would stand in whose shoes? Does Investors Bank stand in the shoes of Citi? Is it the other way around? That's never explained. And just a couple points in closing. Citi had a choice in this note. It could have used a non-negotiable note. Sometimes they were used. Generally, lenders have chosen negotiable notes because of the array of defenses that are available. But if you choose to go that route, there's some risk that comes along with it, and this case exemplifies some of that risk. So yes, we do think it's the legislature's job to decide whether or not to amend the New Jersey Commercial Code to update it to include the clarifying language in 3309A. And in regard to legislation, Plaintiff and Amicus also mentioned that the legislature has already been active in the area of foreclosures, recently enacting a suite of laws to reform the foreclosure process. And as co-chair of the legislative committee, I concur. I was happy to see us recommend those laws and see them get passed. But they don't, not only did they not address this issue, but they don't address a whole array of issues that come up every day in the context of foreclosure claims. And this court, in this case, can contribute to clarifying the process a little more, so hopefully we can get over that bump of being the number one foreclosure state in the country. I saw recently we'd ascended or descended a couple steps, which is a good trend.
Professor, I think we have your argument.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Howley.
May it please the court, Mr. Chief Justice, fellow justices of the Supreme Court. The question before the court is, may an assignee of a promissory note enforce the note with a lost note affidavit when the assignee did not lose the original? This court should affirm the appellate division's well-reasoned and sensible decision based upon principles of both law and equity in order to avoid an absurd result. Defendant's primary argument is that 3309A of the New Jersey UCC must be read literally and in isolation to prevent investors from enforcing the note because investors did not possess the original note when it was lost. Defendant's literal reading of Section 3309A, however, would reach an absurd result, which this court always seeks to avoid. There are several different reasons why the appellate division decision should be affirmed. First, the leading case that defendants rely upon, Dennis Joslin, admitted right in its holding that it had, quote, no logical reason. As a result, that case should not be followed here. Adopting defendants' argument would lead to instances where long-defaulted borrowers, like defendants, could escape liability on promissory notes and receive an unwarranted windfall. Adopting defendants' argument would lead to situations where original notes that are not lost, but that are destroyed by fire, by flood, or stolen, would be unmarketable and unsaleable. Each of these absurd scenarios can be avoided by affirming the sensible decision of the appellate division. Second, Section 3309A is silent on the issue of whether the right to enforce a lost, destroyed, or stolen promissory note is assignable. Section 1103A provides in part that the UCC, quote, shall be liberally construed to promote its underlying purposes, end quote, which are to simplify, clarify, and modernize law governing commercial transactions and to expand commercial practices, as the appellate division correctly observed. Moreover, 3309A does not state that only the party that loses the original note is entitled to enforce it. This court should read 3309 and the UCC as a whole sensibly and conclude that they do not bar the assignment of interest in a lost note. Third, 3309 does not displace principles of law and equity. As noted, foreclosure is an equitable remedy governed by equitable principles. Section 1103B provides that, unless displaced by particular provisions of the UCC, the principles of law and equity supplement its provisions. As this court has noted, statutes are to be interpreted in a way to have the least effect on common law. This court may rely upon the statutory or common law doctrines of assignment to determine that investors is entitled to enforce the note. This court may also rely upon the equitable doctrines of unjust enrichment or subrogation because defendants will receive an unwarranted windfall, as noted, if investors is not entitled to enforce the note. Defendants are simply exploiting the happenstance of a lost original note. Equitable principles are designed to protect against just such a situation. Fourth and finally, Section 3309 should be read in harmony with the entire body of New Jersey statutory law. Again, this court interprets statutes sensibly. NJSA 2A25-1 allows for all contract rights and choses in action to be assigned. That statute applies here. Neither defendants nor the amici supporting them ever have addressed 2A:25-1. If this court accepts defendants' position, this general assignment statute would be silently repealed, a result that this court disfavors. For these four reasons, the appellate division decision should be affirmed.
When are you done with your opening statement?
Sorry?
You completed your opening statement?
Yes, Your Honor.
One of the amici said that 2A25-1 doesn't apply because a chosen action is not a negotiable instrument, is not a chosen action for purposes of that statute. What's your response to that?
Justice Patterson, I believe a case from 1845 was alluded to that I'm not familiar with. In our brief, we referred...
Well, only some members of the court were practicing at that time.
Who are you pointing at?
No comment, Your Honor. We referred the court to an appellate division case, New Century Financial 437 NJ Super at 315, which held that all assigned debts are considered choses in action. So I'm just not aware of the case that's being referenced.
What was I'm sorry, 437 New Jersey Super?
At 315, Your Honor. It's New Century Financial.
So equity requires clean hands.
Yes, Your
correct?
Honor.
Correct?
Yes.
So assuming that the plain language of 309 says that Citibank did not have, the person who took the lost note affidavit from Citibank had no right to enforce the note. Assuming it says that's the plain language, then why should you, lenders, be able to enforce it if you don't have clean hands? You took it when you should have known that you wouldn't be able to enforce it.
Justice Albin, a couple of points in response. First, you have to read 3309. Your question presumes that 3309 is clear on its face, and we don't concede that. There's no question that 3309 does not address assignability. In fact, the UCC as a whole does not address assignability.
If you look at the language, like if a person not in possession of an instrument, and then it goes back to if the person was in possession and entitled to enforce it when lost. It seems to be talking about the same person. And it seems that if we superimposed assignability to 309, we're basically jumbling the language of 309.
I don't think we would be jumbling the language, and I would point the court to the 2007 Alabama Supreme Court case that we cited, McNamee, which addresses this point head on and said that we don't read the silence as to assignability as a prohibition. And that's the finding that this court should reach. 3309 does not address assignability. 3301 does not address assignability. The UCC doesn't address assignability.
And you say the assignment statute allows this to be assigned as it's just part of the broad spectrum of rights that contractual rights that are subject to assignment under New Jersey statutory law.
Absolutely.
So that when you read the two together, they can be reconciled if you assume that assignment is not covered in that statute and look to the general assignment.
That's correct, Your Honor, and they should be read in harmony.
And that could actually explain the legislature's inaction, as long as we're throwing around possible explanations for something we know nothing about.
That's correct, Your Honor. I'd also point out that we cited a case to the court called Cato Parish, 2001 Fifth Circuit case. There was a question about other states having a general assignability statute. Well, Cato Parish, the Fifth Circuit case, relied upon the fact that Louisiana had a general assignment statute very similar to the New Jersey assignment statute. So if this court were to accept defendant's argument, it needs to wrestle with the applicability of the general assignment statute, putting aside the common law doctrine of assignment, which is also, we contend, clearly preserved under 1103 of the UCC. As well as the common law doctrine of unjust enrichment, the common law doctrine of subrogation. Basically, this court has several different options in order to affirm the appellate division.
Do we know, do you know, I certainly don't, what the whether the states that have gone in the other direction or did before they changed their statutes to conform with the 2002 amendments had general assignment statutes that were similar to ours?
Justice Patterson, I did not look at that specific issue. What I can tell you is I've read every case on this issue, and the ones that come out in the defendant's favor, none of them address a general assignment statute.
Okay, so we don't know whether it wasn't raised, or we don't know if it didn't exist, but they are not. You didn't see any case that where the UCC provision was said to trump a general assignment statute.
I did not see one, Justice Patterson.
What do you make of the fact that many courts have not gone your way, with or without an assignment statute?
Justice Lavecchia,
are they absurd?
I'm sorry?
Are they absurd?
I think they are absurd, Your Honor. I think that they take an overly narrow view of how statutes should be interpreted. Justice Timpone referred to DeLisa. We cited the Thompson case from this court with respect to avoiding absurd results. Learned Hand said that if you want to misread a document, read it literally.
Well, what is absurd, but
it's absurd.
If the person that loses the note is the only person to enforce the note, and if you're aware of that, and therefore you should not be, purchasing the lost note affidavit, why is that absurd? It only becomes absurd is because you purchased something you shouldn't have purchased, and now you can't enforce it, and now you're claiming it's absurd.
Justice Alvin,
are you following me?
I think what is absurd about it is the end result. And the end result here is we have several different paths that this court can go down, as I've said. If we accept the defendant's argument, putting aside whether or not Citi could buy back the loan, which is speculation, we don't know.
Have you tried? Have you called up Citi and said, I'd like you to buy this back?
I have not, Your Honor, and I've not because we have been successful in this case. And I believe we're going to be successful here because I believe our arguments are the better arguments. Our cases that we cite are the better cases. They're better reasoned. And if you look at the UCC as a whole, you have to just look at 1103A, which says that the UCC is to be liberally construed. 1103B talks about supplementing. If there was ever a situation where supplementation was warranted, this is it. Because if Investors is not able to enforce and Citi doesn't buy back the loan, then Mr. Torres gets a free house.
But we don't know that because you haven't approached Citi. So now you're speculating. We have no idea that there is an absurd
but
result.
But Justice Albin, with all due respect, this issue was not raised until we were in the appellate division. And so
I'm not blaming you.
No,
right.
I understand.
There's no reason for you to be calling Citi.
I understand, but Justice Albin, at the end of the day, this court wants to get to the right result. Their argument is based upon a case from 1997 where the judge wrote, this is an illogical holding. I don't think this court should endorse a position that is illogical.
Following that up, the suggestion of the ALI comments was that they didn't particularly agree, but they were attempting to clarify. Would you agree with that?
They certainly did not agree with Dennis Joslin. The comment says this amendment is being suggested as a rejection of Dennis Joslin. And obviously I concede that New Jersey has not adopted the amendment from 2002, but I believe, as Justice Patterson points out, this court doesn't read much into legislative inaction. And as the appellate division correctly said, it's a weak reed to lean on, it's a poor beacon to follow, and it shouldn't be followed here. We cited cases between...
But there's more than just inaction. I mean, you heard the colloquies with your friends on the other side, that there was different language used in the earlier statute that worked along the lines of ownership, and the legislature moved to possession. Possession is clearly different. And maybe your assignability argument would have fit better under an ownership terminology had that language stayed. But our legislature chose something different. And it's not as if it's our legislature's inaction alone. There are many states that have not followed up with the UCC's amended language since they adopted it in 2002. Many of them. And there are also many high courts and courts of other states that have heard the same assignability argument raised in exactly the same way and rejected it, because we follow the literal language as the UCC has been drafted, and it's very carefully drafted. So I know you think this is an easy case. I beg to differ. I do think there is a strong position that goes in the other direction.
Justice Lovecki, I by no means meant any disrespect that this is an easy case. We're here. There is a split of authority. There is the 2002 amendment. There is ample reason to be here. In response to your question, I would point out that after the 2002 amendment, in states that did not amend, we cited three cases. The Alabama Supreme Court case from 2007, we cited the Allen case from the Ninth Circuit in 2012, and we cited, I think it's Sterenberger from a Washington State appellate case, where in the face of the amendment, and putting aside all of the law in this state that legislative inaction is a weak beacon, or a weak reed to lean on, those cases, those courts still said, we see the 2002 amendment and we see that our states haven't adopted it, and nevertheless, they said, it would be an absurd result to read 3309 in accordance with Joslyn, in accordance with the argument that the defendants are making here.
And what about, what do you do with the fact that our New Jersey bankruptcy court went in an opposite direction than you're suggesting?
Justice, I'm familiar with the Kemp case. Decision. Mm-hmm. I don't agree with it. It was
court relied on the bankruptcy court in Massachusetts.
Yes,
pointed
Your Honor.
To Seven Oaks, Emerald Portfolio, Jones, Corsetti.
Yes, and I'm familiar with all of those cases. And those cases, again, they do not address the assignability question. They do not address common law doctrines. They do not address other things. The analysis in those cases are respectfully thin as compared to the cases that investors
Seven Oaks addressed the assignability question. Seven Oaks addressed the assignability argument that you made.
That's the Connecticut
case.
That's
the Connecticut case.
You're correct.
And there are others.
But I don't
that
believe
have
that they addressed the whether or not Connecticut has a general assignment statute. I believe
that
they were addressing it under the common law doctrine of assignment. So that's how I would distinguish
and
that.
Were, any of the, were most of those cases foreclosure cases, which are a little bit of a different animal.
Justice Solomon, I will say some. Dennis Joslin, which is the original case, was not a foreclosure case. It was just a suit on a note. Some are foreclosure cases, and I agree
with
you.
But many are notes that are at issue in a bankruptcy proceeding.
In a bankruptcy proceeding or in a not tied to a mortgage. And again, I as this court I'm sure is aware, this holding is going to go beyond just the mortgage foreclosure context. It's going to deal with all notes that are subject to New Jersey law. And again, as I mentioned, we're focusing almost exclusively on notes that are lost, but it's very easy to envision other scenarios involving notes, such as a fire destroys a building, or notes are stolen, or
it provides quite an, and I'm not referring to this scenario at all in this case, but there may be situations where someone could manage to steal somebody's file and take the original note if they had an incentive to think, I never have to pay it.
That's absolutely correct, Justice Patterson. So it's not hard to envision scenarios where a ruling that only the party that loses the original note is entitled to enforce it would lead to a bad result.
With all the potential ramifications that you're concerned about, why has there not been an effort to ask the legislature to clarify the law in this area in the direction that you request?
Justice
you know?
Slovakia, again, I think your question presumes that there was that 3309 is clear and unambiguous.
Well, I can't imagine this is the first bundled lost note situation to arise in New Jersey. And the business community is well organized, so it's not like they don't know how to go to the legislature.
Justice Slovecki, I can't speak to that.
Perhaps your colleague can.
Perhaps my colleague can, yes. Mr. Lubertazzi, who's here on behalf of the BIA.
That will be helpful. Thank you.
Anything else you'd like to add?
I don't have anything further unless there are any other questions.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you. May it please the court. The theme that I come to this argument is that people are not perfect. Documents get lost. And the question becomes, what do you do when a document is lost? The other theme I have is people should pay their obligations. And then it comes down to how do we proceed with those two themes? And the issue, and Mr. Howley sort of stole my thunder a little bit, as I'm sitting here listening to the argument, there are a lot of questions about what happens in a mortgage foreclosure. And can you assign the note back to the bank? And really what this court is being asked to do is to interpret 3-309. Article 3 of the Uniform Commercial Code is not limited to mortgage foreclosures. And I would ask you to remember that as you're analyzing this case and any decision you might make as to whether or not your holding is very limited having to do with a mortgage foreclosure. And there are some variations that would apply, such as in an indemnity situation, and who is the holder of the actual creditor, so to speak, it's very easy to give indemnification, because when you're in a mortgage situation, then you have the recording statutes, and you have an assignment of mortgage, and it's hard for there to be a ghost creditor, so to speak. We also have the strong statutory protection for mortgagors, the anti-deficiency statute, where if you want to bring a deficiency action on a residential mortgage, you have to do so within 6 months, and it reopens the right of redemption. And in my 30-plus years of foreclosing on a fair amount in New Jersey, mostly commercial, I have never seen a deficiency action brought on a residential foreclosure. So any decision you make today is going to go well beyond mortgage foreclosures. There were also a number of comments about, well, why can't investors just assign the note back to Citi, and has investors tried to do so? Since we're dealing with Article 3, there are a myriad number of situations that can occur where assignment is not possible, where you have a situation where a corporation happened to be the holder of a note that gets lost. That note, that corporation decides to liquidate and signs a lost note affidavit. The assignee in that situation cannot go back to the dissolved corporation. It may be that the note was held by an individual who has passed away. So you have that situation. I also, I think one of the cases, and it may have been Dennis Jolson, was an FDIC case where a bank was taken over, and the FDIC, in its statutory mandate to maximize the value of assets, sold the note. When you're dealing with a failed bank, not unusual to find inadequate record keeping to find the original note. So you have a situation where if this court says under those circumstances, the assignee is required to go back to the entity that lost the note, that's a situation that can occur. And again, there's been a lot of discussion by my respected adversaries about, well, this is the bank, and it's almost like enforcing strict liability on the bank. I would posit the situation for the state of New Jersey where the Department of Banking and Insurance decides to take over an insurance company and then decides to liquidate the assets of the insurance company. I'm dating myself. I was very involved in mutual benefit life insurance which was liquidated. Mutual Benefit Life Insurance was the holder of many, many notes.
That was before my time.
So. I understand that.
It wasn't.
Solomon. I'm a lot older than I look. But you can have all those situations. So a situation like that, and there's some talk about the secondary market, and there's some discussion that there's been no proof, so to speak. It's common sense that if the state of New Jersey or the rehabilitator, the liquidator in that situation, is unable to transfer the lost note by a lost note affidavit, then that note effectively becomes worthless.
And in that kind of mutual benefit being a great example of that, you have people whose policyholders end up with no assets or
exactly.
fewer assets because those assets are unavailable.
Exactly.
Mr. Howley said that you would inform us as to whether or not you've gone to the legislature in answer to Justice LaVecchia's question.
We have not. We did not see a need to.
Okay.
Justice Rabner pointed out, and in preparing for the argument, I found a confusing issue in the sense of if you look at our New Jersey statutes annotated and you look at 3-309, it shows that we're under the 1995 Uniform Commercial version of the Uniform Commercial Code. But what follows is the Uniform Commercial Code comment from the 2002 version of the UCC. And as Justice Rabner specifically said, comment 2 says, we reject Dennis Joslin, the transferee of a lost note is entitled to enforce it. So when you get into legislative intent, if I'm a legislature and I pick up the book and I read this, I say there is no issue. I would advise the court that
OLS makes mistakes sometimes.
Well, I would advise the court that I did contact my office and say, please check this because I must be missing something. And they must have looked at Westlaw or Lexis or something like that, which I don't use. And they said that following that is the UCC comment to the 1995 version. So
but
I don't want to mislead the court.
You can't use the 202 comment to interpret the 1995 law. That's like a future legislature. You're saying that it knew the intent of the legislature 20 years earlier.
No.
It could be that you can interpret it that they think it complies with 202. That's why there was no need to change it.
That's correct. It was just so.
Well, yes, the 202 ALI, but
no.
But
that's not what I said. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I think your point. See if I understand your point. That perhaps the legislature, in looking at this and seeing that comment, thought we don't have a problem because it's clear.
Anything. We don't have to.
Thought anything at all, if they've ever considered this.
And that's correct. And there's been a number of comments here about other states and the majority view. I'm very comfortable with the New Jersey statutory scheme. Besides the UCC saying that we are not displacing common law, equitable jurisdiction, equitable principles, unjust enrichment, whatever that may be, we have the assignment provisions of the two statutes, 2A25-1, and the mortgage assignment. So we have a comprehensive scheme that such that 3-309 cannot be read in isolation. I would disagree with Justice Albin on that the statute is plain. It is the position of investors, it's in, the position of the industry, that the word only is not in the statute. So what you come up with is that if you look at the history of negotiable instruments, there's a 1935 case that was cited by the parties, whereas you have to be in possession of a negotiable instrument in order to enforce it. And then in 1975, I believe it was, the UCC is enacted, and we have 3-804, which talks about an owner of a lost instrument being able to enforce it. And the commentary says this is new. In other words, we're going to deal with those imperfect situations where a document gets destroyed.
As Justice LaVecchia had pointed out, the previous iteration of 3804 seems to have permitted assignability, but then the legislature chose this language. And I'm trying to understand how this language is susceptible to an assignment. So I'm just going to read it, and maybe you can help me. A person, not in possession of an instrument, is entitled to enforce the instrument if the person was in possession of the instrument and entitled to enforce it when loss of possession occurred. That seems to be the person, a person, and the person refers back to a person. So I'm trying to figure out how assignability applies to that language.
Three comments. First of all, the word only is not in there. But it does specifically say that a person who was in possession who lost it can enforce it. So the word, it doesn't say only that person can enforce it. I also like the fact that Your Honor pointed to the word a person, because most of the colloquy by the panel before was, we're focusing on possession, we're focusing on possession, which has always been the law for negotiable instruments. But here, the legislature said, or adopting the 1995 version of the UCC, said a person. Didn't say an owner, didn't say a holder, didn't say a transferee. They used the word person. And so, really, my third comment would be that the person who lost the note is entitled to enforce it. And what's happening here is that the person entitled to enforce it is assigning the right to enforce it.
And is doing so as under our general assignment statute.
That's right. And the other thing, too, that I would point out, that 3309 imposes benefits and burdens. The benefit is, and I think this is the limited issue before the court, which is if I walk into the Chancery Division on a foreclosure matter, or if I walk into the Law Division to enforce a note, my opening comment is, I can enforce this note. I'm an assignee with a lost note affidavit. That gets me into the courtroom. Our trial judges, who are very experienced in dealing this, especially our foreclosure judges, then apply the statute. And when you look at 3309, C, it talks about that the plaintiff, when I walk into court, has to show that I am now the owner, or I'm properly there as a plaintiff.
Do you see 3309 as conferring a right on the person who lost the note to then assign that right along with other contractual rights?
Yes.
Under the general assignment statute?
Yes, subject
so,
to all
so
the
way you would piece those two together is, this deals with the person who comes in and says, I don't know, I can't find this thing, I had it, I don't have it anymore, but clarifies that person has the right to enforce, and that person can then assign the right to enforce.
Correct. And then when we're in trial court, the statute itself says that the plaintiff, the person who has walked in, has to prove that, for lack of a better word, they're the holder. They have to prove the terms of the documents. And the court has the ability to, not ability, has the requirement to provide indemnification. And when you provide the indemnification, as I started out before, we have a situation where in a mortgage foreclosure, there's a lot of certainty because we have the recording statutes. If you're dealing with a negotiable instrument in the Law Division, we're going to have to look at the facts of that particular case. And our trial judges are more than able to deal with that. If there's a situation where it's a negotiable instrument, it may be that the trial judge says, in this situation, plaintiff, you have to post a letter of credit, something like that. There's variables. There's no limit.
Going back to the interpretation of the statute, I'm not going to belabor this. When reading it, the first a person, and then it goes to the person.
Yes.
The person is referring back to the first person, no?
Correct. The person in possession when it was lost.
So if you're assigning it, aren't you switching? There's going to be one person and then another person.
No, because that person, by contract, no longer has any rights to enforce that note. They've done
it. So it's a person not in possession. That would be your assignee.
Correct.
Right? And then the second, if the person was in possession of an instrument and entitled to enforce it when loss of possession occurred,
right,
that could never be the
was
assignee.
That, did you mean to say
person?
That you said it was the assignee, the person, or the assignor?
It would always be the assignee. So what 3309A talks about is, because we're dealing with negotiable instruments, to promote commercial transactions and certainty. In that circumstance, even though I don't have an original note, and I'm not going to get into the evidence questions, but the evidence questions is really just admissibility versus weight and the ability of the other side to come in and question it. But the in that situation, the holder who, or the person in possession when it was lost, has the right to come in and enforce that note.
But isn't that the assignor then?
That's the assignor.
No.
That person can assign that enforcement.
That's what I'm saying.
But aren't you reading the temporal requirement right out? Because the last part before the comma requires it to be when loss of possession occurred.
I'm not.
Tell me why not.
It has to be a party in the party able to enforce it.
The party not in possession is entitled to enforce if that person, it says the person, but you agreed it's the same person, was in possession of the instrument and entitled to enforce it when loss of possession occurred. And that's the temporal requirement. It sounds to me like you're reading out of that first clause.
I'm not. That is basically, I view that as basic negotiable instruments where you have to come into court with the original. And here, 3-804 was a new section to get over the situation of a lost negotiable instrument, which was then followed or replaced with 3309.
But let me just understand something. Is city the quote-unquote person in the
yes.
statute as applied here?
Yes.
And I think you answered Justice Salvin's question saying it's the assignee.
No.
Is the person. You meant assignor.
If I did, I apologize.
Yeah, I was trying to, it's the assignor. You're saying this covers the rights of city, assuming they filled out the note, lost note affidavit. This covers their rights and governs their rights, but they were able to assign their right to enforce.
That's exactly right. And again, if you look at the history going back to, I think it's the 1935 case that was cited by the appellants, where if you're not in possession, you can't enforce the negotiable instrument.
Right. So then Justice Levecki is concerned correctly about the temporal requirement is met because city is that person and owned it at the time it was lost.
Correct.
But the assignment statute, and obviously common law as well, allows the assignment.
Correct.
And therefore, we're not the 3309 does not cover the assignee.
Correct. What couple other comments?
Well, I wouldn't say my concern is addressed with that.
No.
Thank you.
But one of them was.
I want to respond to a couple other comments.
Let me ask you to do that briefly if you can.
Yes, Justice Wright. There was the comment about, I'm not here to criticize Mr. Torres at all. Prior to recent enactment of some bills by Governor Murphy, it was a 20-year mortgage statute of limitations. So that if you had a situation where you couldn't enforce the note and the borrower decided to sell the house to clear title, they'd have to figure out what to do on a cloud of title. That position is now only 6 years. So this is a real issue. And again, my concluding comment is your decision here has far-reaching consequences beyond the mortgage foreclosure. And our trial courts are able to deal with, is the lost note affidavit proper? Has the transfer been made? Does it come into evidence? The appellants talk about robo-signing. They talk about predatory lending. They talk about a number of attacks on the banking system. And there have been abuses. But here, the abuses, hopefully a lot of them have been minimized, and the trial courts know how to deal with it. The trial courts know how to deal with providing indemnification. And so for all those reasons, I come back to my theme. People are not perfect. They lose documents. One of my clients just lost $18 million worth of notes. Fortunately, they're still the holder, so I don't have the situation of an assignment, but I just filed final judgment application papers on $18 million. McCarter and English had the originals. We returned it back to the Bank of China, and they lost them. So it happens. Innocent. So, and you have the indemnification rights. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Briefly to address the just first issue, the new statute regarding the shortening of the statute of limitations only applies to loans executed after that date and would not impact this case or others like it. I think that's a non-issue. To get to the heart of the rebuttal, To suggest that the Uniform Commercial Code does not at all is silent on assignment, I think, is a fallacy. The UCC uses the word transfer as opposed to assignment, and I do not think that there is in reality a difference. But what will happen if this court looks to other statutes or common law using the word assignability, they will in effect eliminate the application of Section 3203, Section 3301, and Section 3309 of the UCC. Because very clearly, 203 says an instrument is transferred when it is delivered. That is in effect the UCC's version of assignability. 309 explains that enforcement occurs when you're in possession, the lone exception, of course, being loss under 3309. And as Justice Album was pointing out, in the plain language, only a person who was in possession of a lost instrument can enforce the lost instrument.
Where does the word only appear?
The word only is not literally in the language, but
isn't that a pretty important fact?
I do not believe that the word only needs to be there. I think that it makes it clear when it says a person not in possession of an instrument is entitled to enforce the instrument if the person, not if a person, but if the person, right, that same person was in possession of the instrument at the time of the loss. And I want to make one more thing clear. There was a lot of discussion, particularly during Mr. Halley's discussion with the court, regarding circumstances where, or maybe it was during amicus, but where there are seizures or a company goes out of business. 3309 makes a clear carve out for that. It says that where loss occurred not as the result of a lawful seizure or a circumstance of that nature. And so I do not believe that that danger in the marketplace would be at issue by anything that the court decides here today. I think 3309 makes clear that when the FDIC becomes involved because of a bank failure and they can't locate notes, that is not an issue. When New Century was found to have shredded instruments, that's not an issue. But if we have a circumstance where the court gets rid of the plain language of 3309 and adopts common law principles or outside statutes for assignability, then truly these other sections of the UCC will be rendered ineffectual. And I do think that we will have, as I said earlier, I've in speaking with other counsel, I've had the most lost note cases of anyone that I know, and it's 4. But I think that if the court were to rule that 3309 allows for transferability, that we're going to see a lot more lost note cases, because it will incentivize the path of least resistance, which is just show up with a photocopy and a loose affidavit that says, I looked for it, I couldn't find it, without ever stating that I once had it. Unless the court has any more questions, I'll leave it there.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you to counsel for the very fine arguments. We're going to take a brief recess and come back to the disciplinary matters.